Northwestern Michigan College
Driveways.
From the mobile studio at Northwestern Michigan College and the Department of Extended Educational Services, you're listening to NMC Driveways. Hi, John Plow here. Today we take to the skies. Alex Bloy is the Director of Aviation at NMC. He's also the father of YouTube sensations Addison and Chuck Bloy. In this episode, the Hawk Owl Minute makes its triumphant return. We'll see how Alex does. We're really glad you're listening. I couldn't convince Alex to do this interview while piloting an airplane, something about FAA regulations, so we're in Williamsburg in our cars in his driveway, just like two normal guys making a podcast during a global pandemic. Alex Bloy, welcome to the show. Thank you for having me in your driveway.
Thank you, John. It's nice to have you here.
During the last few months during the pandemic, your daughters have become national, maybe international TV stars. Tell me about this project that's ongoing in your household.
I wish I could take any ounce of credit for this. It is all Addison and my wife, Stephanie. And of course, their co-host, Charlie. It wasn't my idea. I had nothing to do with it. One day they decided they wanted to put out a newscast. It was just for fun. They were just joking around and they put out Good News Michigan. Addison actually prefers, she's more into the production of everything. She likes the post-production. She likes working with the videos and the sounds and the effects. That's her thing. But she's also had a lot of fun putting this news production together. So every couple weeks, they've been putting out a Good News Michigan and posting it to YouTube. And sure enough, our friends at Up North Live picked it up, and they've been running it when we put them out. So yes, my daughter, Addison, is convinced that when she's back into town that she will be a recognizable star.
When you were their age, did you have that classic dream of flying an airplane, Alex?
I've always been into airplanes. My dad was in the Air Force, and he wasn't a pilot, but he talked to me about the airplanes. He worked on them, and we built models together. And when I was 10, I traveled to the UK with my parents, and it was a fantastic experience. And I remember the airplane more than the trip. I never thought about flying as an option for a career. I don't know why, but I thought a career had to be something that wasn't as fun and just was more traditional. I always thought airplanes were amazing and that they were meant for people in the military and maybe people who could afford it. I never considered that it was a possibility for me.
So what changed?
I found flying in kind of a weird way, almost backwards. So I went to Michigan State and graduated with a degree in environmental studies. And I was a cartographer, so I designed maps for land use analysis. I worked for a nonprofit here in town that still exists, and moved into Traverse City, had my first real job, and thought that was it. This was what I was supposed to be doing.
What does land use analysis mean?
People
are taking these maps,
right?
And what information are they getting from them?
The easiest thing I can tell you is I used to draw plat maps, so ownership maps. If you were to purchase a Leelanau County plat map 10 years ago, chances are I was the one who drew it. It depended on what the grant was that we were currently working on, what the mission of the grant was. But all of it was pro-environment and pro-community development, sort of smart community development. I was a technician that supplied data in map form. So that's what I did. I sat at a desk and I looked at aerial photos and different data sets and compiled visual maps for people to make decisions on.
Did you think of yourself as an artist?
No, my father is an artist and I have a lot of artists in my family. I don't have that ability. it was artistic in a sense. There was layout to it, and there were color designs and selections and things like that. But it wasn't, the end result was not, I didn't look at it as art. It was data. It was a tool to make decisions. So, and it was a good job. It was fun in a sense, but there was no adventure to it. It was the same thing every day. I would go in and I would draw maps. That lasted for about a year. And then in 2001, I felt as if I was really relatively new to the community, was looking for a new adventure and just a new challenge, a new way to meet people. And I caught an ad, I believe in the Record Eagle, for an introductory flight lesson at NMC. So come out, take an airplane ride, you know, just check us out. And so I thought, wow, that's cool. I've never been in a small airplane before. I've been in airliners, but I've never sat up front. Why not? So I went out to the airport, Parsons Stulen, and I met Bob Bottleman, the director at the time, who's still an advisor of mine. He set me up with an instructor. His name was Brian, and we took a flight, and he took me up flying. And I will never forget lifting off a runway 28 at Traverse City and asking Brian. I had the controls. He had given me the flight controls to take off. And I said, so this is your job? This is what you do? And he said, yeah. And we were the same age. And I said, I don't understand. How does this happen? And he's like, well, you go to school at NMC and they teach you how to do this and you'd be a pilot. Like, what? Where have I gone wrong? You know, it was amazing. And so I'll never forget that flight. I actually went back to the office. It was a midday flight. It was a lunch. I went back to the office and quit my job.
For those of us that have only been on a commercial flight, what is the difference between me sitting in a middle seat on a flight from Detroit to Boston and the experience that you had?
Flying versus riding, there's so many differences. But, you know, when you're sitting on a bus or a train and you're in the back, you're blindly seeing the world go by at the side and there's no real control over it. And you're putting your faith in whoever's driving this machine that you're going to get to your destination. Same thing in an airliner. You know, you're in the back and you might see, you know, a cloud or two. You might catch a glimpse of a city. When you're up front, you are in control of the machine and the view is unreal. You don't have a sensation of an aircraft behind you. You almost feel like you're floating. I mean, it's really hard to explain, but it's a completely different view. It's a completely different sensation. Even people who get airsick, oftentimes they don't suffer from being airsick when they are when they're riding up front, when they're controlling the aircraft, because there's a predictability to it. You can sort of see what's approaching you. You fly through clouds. You see the world in an amazing perspective. And when I took off over Traverse City, it was fall. The colors had changed. The water was amazingly crystal clear blue. You would have thought you were flying over the Caribbean. It was just phenomenal. And every time I take off over Traverse City, I'm still at awe of the beauty of the area that only a few of us really ever get to see.
So when you were imagining yourself in this new life, what were you picturing yourself doing?
I didn't know. I run into a lot of students like that today where not everybody wants to be an airline pilot. It's great, and it's a solid choice for a lot of people. Good career track that can be very lucrative. I wasn't interested in the airlines, and I don't know why. I liked flying smaller aircraft. I liked being at the lower altitudes. I really liked the connectivity with passengers. You know, so an airline pilot doesn't necessarily shake hands with their passengers. They don't get to know them. They don't know where they're taking them. When I became a charter pilot, I really liked the mission, the uniqueness of the mission and helping the individual get to a doctor's appointment or a funeral or a vacation or wherever they were going. I really liked being a part of that. And so I stuck with small aircraft. I found that I really liked the business aspect of aviation as well. So I really liked working with regulations and policymakers and negotiating procurement of aircraft and hiring and mentoring younger instructors. And my passion really grew in that area. I will always love flying, and I miss it every day that I'm not flying. But I really like the other aspects of aviation as well. A position opened up at Eastern Michigan University through a connection. I knew actually a fellow alumni at NMC. I learned of this position and was offered the job of director of aviation at Eastern. Almost to the day, my friend Aaron Cook was named the new director of aviation at NMC, same year and same month. And I believe we were two of the youngest collegiate aviation directors in the country at the time, in our mid-20s. And we sort of grew up together in those roles. So we shared a lot of notes. We compared our program direction, our vision and mission, and what we were doing. And we just leaned on each other quite a bit to develop our individual programs. So I was the director of Eastern Michigan University's aviation program for about 4 years, from 08 to 2012.
How many aviation programs are there in the world or in the state? I have no sense of this happens at every school or this is only in four schools.
It's about in four schools, yeah. Each state that probably averages two or three collegiate aviation programs. The United States has the largest cohort of collegiate programs, but you will also find them in Australia, China, a limited number in the UK. The rest of the world doesn't have the access to the airspace like we do. Our airspace is sort of like state land. I mean, it's or like a lake. It's open access. And so if you're qualified and proficient and current, you have the right to access that space. It's not like that in the rest of the world. Pilots are drawn to the United States for training.
When you were in South Carolina, how was flying there different than it is in northern Michigan?
Flying on the East Coast is fantastic and challenging at the same time. The traffic volume is unreal, and it's very strategic in the way you have to plan your flights. So it's not just from A to B direct flight. You are taking routes. They're driving traffic volumes in specific routes. So it was extremely busy. The weather, especially in the southern states, was wildly unpredictable. You'd get afternoon thunderstorms that would just pop up constantly. But it was fun. I felt like I had access to the world. I mean, I could go to the Bahamas, the Gulf Coast, or up to New York. And it seemed like everything was about 3 hours away, flight time. I used to have dreams about the GPS clock ticking down from 3 hours in the aircraft I was flying. everything was 3 hours. The access, I felt like part of the world there. Whereas up here, we're north of everything. You know, we even have to drive an hour just to get to a freeway. I love that up here, actually. I love being disconnected, and I love the ability to enjoy the airspace and send our students up in it and not have to worry that it's going to be too crowded for them.
Where's the easiest place to fly, and where's the most difficult?
Weather is everything. Weather's our top priority. Every single day I wake up in the morning, I check the weather. Even the past 3 months, I wake up in the morning and check the weather.
Where does a person like you check the weather? Is it a different place than I am checking the weather?
Quite possibly. There's a website, aviationweather.gov. It's the NOAA website, but it's translated into aviation reports. The weather's a big factor. It's a big factor in northern Michigan. We see it as a positive. So yeah, you could fly in Arizona and have 70 to 90 degrees and blue skies year-round, you know, 350 days out of the year. But we don't believe you're going to be the most confident pilot at the end of that. So those students, just like our students, go right from there to the airlines, and they've never seen snow. They've never seen a cloud. They've never flown through a cloud or through rain. I remember the first time I flew through rain, and I was concerned that the rain was going to do something to the aircraft and somehow. And I know every new student goes through that same feeling. But it doesn't. It just means the aircraft is wet at that point, and it's just like your car. A lot of students in Arizona, California, Florida will just never experience the weather patterns that we do here. And we believe it's an advantage for our graduates.
So talk me through the experience of a student.
Some students have some experience. Some students have no experience. We've had students that don't even have driver's licenses or know how to ride a bike, or you know, they just have very little life experience in operating any sort of machine. But they have fallen in love with flying for some reason, whether they want to travel or they just don't want to be in an office or you know, whatever it is. most of them have a commonality in that they have someone who mentored them, someone who turned them onto it and pushed them to call.
If they've had experience, how did that happen? How does someone accidentally have piloting experience?
There are a lot of private schools. So if you went to your local small airport, let's say Antrim County, just north of us here, typically there's a flight instructor there and an airplane and they give lessons. And you can do that. You can just take private lessons, just like you take ski lessons. You can go and get this relatively same credential, not necessarily the same experience, but you can get a private pilot license. That's our first credential. A lot of students in high school, because of the demand for pilots and the wait list to get into schools in the United States, most students coming in had already gotten their private pilot license in high school. So they went to their local school and signed up and started taking lessons. But a lot of our students come with zero time. And the first week, we do an orientation. And the next, we do an orientation on the first Friday. And then the next Monday, they are flying. About a month later, they take their first solo flight, which is a day that no one will ever forget.
That's so fast. I'm so
it
scared.
Is. Yeah.
You just stressed me out.
It is. It's very strict, though. It's under strict confines. We have a process, and it works. Some students take a month. Some students take 3 months. It's a motor skill. It's a sport. And so some pick it up quicker than others. Doesn't mean they're any better or any worse. It just means that they're learning at a different on a different road. So, yeah, you'll take your first solo. If everything goes well, that first semester, you'll become a private pilot, a certified private pilot. You take a check ride, which is like a driver's exam, but it's much more intense. There's an oral exam and then a flight exam and a written exam. It's a three-part test for every credential, every certificate that we go through. And we make a big deal out of it. They pass, and then they move on to the next one.
So what is the equivalent to parallel parking for a plane pilot?
The power off 180.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Power off 180. It's an accuracy landing. So it's a reality of flying. We don't beat around the bush when we talk about the fact that an engine could shut down on you and you need to be able to control the aircraft without it. It doesn't happen often. Statistically, it will never happen to anyone, but we have to train for it. And so we train for the power off 180. Now, very clear, we do not shut engines down on single engine aircraft. So when you're in the pattern at the airport, we will pull the power to idle. So you're next to where you want to land. I'm using my hands for a podcast. We'll pull the power to idle when we are abeam the point where we want to land, and we will glide to that point. It's 180 degrees around. So you turn the aircraft, you fly the aircraft 180 degrees. From where you are at 1,000 feet, typically, to where you're going to land on the ground. And it's a pre-designated spot that you have to control the aircraft down to. It can be a difficult maneuver, but it doesn't have to be. I think a lot of it is psychological. I think students psych themselves out on the power off 180 because they hear other students talking about power off 180, just like parallel parking. But oftentimes, like parallel parking, if you just take a breath and ignore the person honking behind you, it's probably easier than you'd imagine. A student works through their ratings. So once they're in, they work through their ratings. They get their private, then their instrument, which is kind of like being able to take the freeway versus the side roads when you're driving. And then they get their commercial pilot license, which certifies them as a commercial pilot, but they're still not qualified to do anything at that point. So in the U.S. system, in the FAA system, most pilots will become flight instructors. It's interesting. So you have your youngest pilots, your most inexperienced pilots, teaching the new pilots. And that's just the system. That's how it works. So we turn over a lot of instructors as they build their experience up. When they meet airline qualifications or wherever they want to go, they leave and they move on. How do you get from this small airplane to flying my family and I in a 90 passenger CRJ out of Traverse City to Chicago? Every single parent asks that question. The way it works, you graduate, you have a commercial pilot license, you become a flight instructor, you build your experience to around 1,200 hours, 1,250 hours to be exact, and then you're hired on by an airline and you're immediately sent back to school. So you go to the airline's training and you learn their aircraft, spend months learning the systems and the emergency procedures and the flight ops. Your training is all in simulation. at the airlines, at the regional airlines. Your first flight normally as a first officer will be with passenger, with a full load of passengers in the back. They don't know it's your first flight. You have a captain sitting next to you, but typically that's how it works.
What is the work that you do in your position?
I am the director of the aviation division, as well as the academic chair. I really like to see myself as a facilitator. I have a team of amazing professionals, most of whom are professional pilots, some of whom aren't though. And my job is to make sure that they have everything they need to do their job. That's all I do. I go to the meetings, I answer the phone calls, I talk to the parents, I write policy, I purchase aircraft, I purchase equipment, look for the next great thing, you know, like electric airplanes. I make sure that we are heading in the right direction. I set the mission and the vision for the department and then let everyone just enjoy their work towards that mission.
So you mentioned electric airplanes. What's the scoop?
That's on the horizon. Before we shut down, that was all the buzz. A lot of manufacturers are in the certification phase, which can take years. We are probably 2 to 3 years out, you know, if not 5 years out from electric airplanes being, you know, the norm or being introduced to the norm, at least. The technology exists, but the facilities don't exist. So you need battery lockers and charging stations and, you know, just like if you had an electric car, it's the infrastructure that we're lacking. But the world is heading towards electric aircraft. They are being flown today. There's operators all over the world that are testing and flying electric aircraft.
Does that scare you at all?
Not a bit. No, not a bit. I think it would be an amazing experience. There's no noise. So there, you can find videos of electric aircraft and there's no noise. There's one moving part. You have the propeller and then just an electric motor that it's hooked to, and that's it. So it's like gliding, but you have power. I would love to take a flight in an electric aircraft. I think it'd be fantastic.
So if we're flying all electric in 50 years and I am a small child in a bathtub playing with a little toy airplane, what sound am I going to be making?
That's a great question. Whoosh.
It doesn't have nearly the cachet of the current sound.
It really doesn't, no. Yeah, you'll see electric aircraft at NMC in the next 10 years.
That's the sound of Swoop the Hawk Owl, Alex, which means it's time for the Hawk Owl Minute.
Super.
Going to ask you a series of questions. Like you to respond as quickly as you can. Don't try to think about it too much.
I have a question before we begin.
Of course.
Is there a score and can I beat Jason Slade?
There is a score. All of our scores are generated via some online algorithms and publicized via our social media channels.
All right, fantastic. I can't wait.
Here we go. Crocs, yes or no?
No.
Pink or purple?
Purple.
Most attractive kind of tree?
Pine.
Houseboat versus RV, who wins?
RV.
Rocking chairs, underrated or overrated?
Overrated.
Nintendo, Atari, or Sega Genesis?
Nintendo.
Is owning a robot lawnmower cheating?
Yes.
The ideal jigsaw puzzle has how many pieces?
2.
Rate your ability to chop wood.
2.
In the world of music, name a song or artist that you and your daughters enjoy.
Pink.
Zip lines, are you a fan?
We have one.
Rank these in order. Yogurt, Greek yogurt, frozen yogurt.
Frozen Greek yogurt.
And that's the Hawk Owl Minute.
Fantastic.
How do you feel you did?
I think I nailed it.
Do you think you beat Jason Slade?
Easily.
We'll find out on social media. What is the most satisfying part of your job?
I love seeing students succeed. That is the cool thing about flight training, is that we don't wait for graduation for celebration. We have celebrations all the way through the training. And to see a student who's dreamed of flight their entire life become a pilot is just fantastic. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Yeah, what are the traditions? I get my 1,250 hours. What happens? Is it a high five?
There's all kinds of different traditions. They used to cut the back of your shirt off when you soloed. I don't know where that came from, but they would cut your shirt off, and then the instructor would sign it and pin it up on the wall. We ring a bell. One of our mentor pilots, actually the chief pilot who was there, Mike Stock, when I was a student, came up with this bell. And so when you solo or you get a rating or you have an accomplishment in the aircraft, you come in, you ring the bell, and it doesn't matter who's in your office or who you're talking to or what you're doing, you stop what you're doing, get up, and you go shake their hand and congratulate them on their victory. You know, the industry's in a funny spot right now. Everybody's saying that aviation has been really hard hit during the pandemic and the shutdown, and that's true. It's short-lived, though. The reality is that during this time, pilots have been retiring. We are at the beginning of a retirement boom. And so when the recovery happens, and it's already happening, there's international lines are opening up. Traffic out of Traverse City is quadruple of what it was just a month ago. So it's already picking back up. When it does, it's going to be even better than it was before. I think it's really important that pilots and anyone who's interested in aviation knows that the outlook is fantastic, and that there's bumpy roads ahead for sure. There's going to be a little turbulence, but not anything we can't get past.
Well, Alex Bloy, this has been such a treat for me to get to hear your story and hear about the aviation program. So thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
I had to find out the history behind cutting the back of a pilot's shirt off following their first solo flight. The consensus seems to be the following. Most traditional training aircraft had tandem seating, meaning one seat in front of the other, with the student in front. So before headset technology got really good, an instructor would commonly have to tug on the back of a student's shirt to get their attention. Cutting a pilot's shirt tail off was a rite of passage, showing there was no need to tug on the student's shirt anymore. That explanation, courtesy of the internet. Oh, and Alex wasn't kidding. His family totally has a zip line in their backyard, and it's amazing. Our theme music is provided by Sweetwave Audio. For custom music, visit sweetwaveaudio.co.uk. NMC Driveways is brought to you by NMC Extended Education. Thanks for listening. I'm John Plow from before. Northwestern Michigan College.
Driveways.